Hello, and welcome to the Dear Infosec podcast. In this episode, you'll learn how punk and bands like the Ramones and the Dead Kennedys can shape a career in information security. And now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to the Dear Infosec podcast, where we talk about, tackle, and even solve some of the many, many problems that practitioners confront every day. So if you have a problem and need someone to help, get in touch at dearinfosec@securityforum.org, and we'll assemble a team of experts to look into your problem and offer advice. Today is the first in an occasional series that we're calling Desert Island Risks, and is like the radio show with a very similar name. If you don't know that show, then it explores a subject's life through music they love or which was playing at particular moments, pivotal experiences, those kinds of things. This is somewhat similar, but we're more interested in risks rather than discs. We're delving into the past of a security leader to find out what shaped them personally and professionally. And the first security leader subject to that delving is Petri Koivisto, who is currently CISO at Finnish steelmaker Outokumpu. Hello, Petri.
Hello.
You're broadcasting from your car, so this is very much a on-the-road type podcast.
Yeah, it's kind of a road trip, you might say, but nevertheless.
Yeah. And you've been at Outokumpu for a couple of years. I'm just curious about what the job entails, because I guess you've got some manufacturing plants and things like that, a lot of physical security. But yeah, curious about what the role covers, really.
Yeah, it's just beginning of August, so I have been in Outokumpu for 2 years. So we're kind of really in short. So I'm responsible for all cybersecurity from office networks to production networks and everything in between. So it's a huge landscape, like you said. So we are in kind of from Europe. We have operations in the US as well. So 4 big plants and lots of service centers. So lots of ground to cover in cyber.
Indeed, I'm sure. And we can dig into that and sort of how you got there and what shapes your approach to the role. But also here is Paul Watts, who has spent a similar amount of time in the security industry. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Just a quick question for you. What shaped you, or indeed your career, or if you can separate the two, which risks or discs, which ones shaped you most?
Oh,
tricky question.
I don't know. I mean, risks, learning about risks makes you stronger. Learning about discs makes you broader, I guess. So a bit of both.
Throwing shapes, that's what it's called.
Throwing shapes.
Yeah. What about you?
Throwing shapes, it's like it's before.
Petri, risks or discs? I don't know which one has been more influential.
I would go with the discs. So I'm a kind of a lots of a music person. So there has been lots of different eras, you know, in music on my path, and there is always, you know, something interesting, maybe as well in my personality as well. So I'm really curious. So I like lots of kind of music. So those are guiding me through different times.
Yeah, it's interesting because I suspect I'm a bit older than both you guys. So punk in the UK was a big influence, because I think my sister was the only punk in West Yorkshire. She was one of the few to own a Sex Pistols album. I don't know, was there a Finnish equivalent of punk at all? Were you in the mosh pit when you were a teenager?
Yeah, I think so. But I think I'm more, or have been more into American punk. So Ramones has been a big influencer. And then there has been, you know, this Finnish equivalent, the Nelu Matt, who was first starting to play these Ramones songs in Finnish. And then they expanded to their area. So that has been kind of my punk era, I would say.
Wow, on that fabulous. Part. Good stuff. How about you, Paul? Do you a punk sort of? Any of that music light your fire? That's a funky thing to say.
I would describe my musical tastes as rather promiscuous, because, you know, the genre of music I'm into generally tends to match my mood. You know, I like everything from jazz all the way across to, you know, ambient or techno, rock, pop, Britpop, a bit of everything, even a bit of classical music from time to time. So, and the thing I say, you know, everybody's been on the Spotify journey, right? I remember upgrading my subscription to a family subscription, giving it to my kids and saying that the best bit of music you'll ever hear is the bit of music you've not heard yet. And there's a parallel there to InfoSec, because we always say that InfoSec is a constant learning journey. I think your musical journey is exactly the same. It never ends. You're always learning something new about the musical world around you. Right. That's my parallel between the two anyway.
Yeah, I would say, and kind of if I'm adding to the punk scene, kind of the Dead Kennedys was one period of my time, and I still listen it once in a while. So I like Yellow in his fabulous voice on that part. But I kind of agree with Paul. So I have been a jazz festival, but then I found out that there is a Finnish jazz, which is kind of insane. So nobody plays in sync, and that's it. That is not for me.
All right. Wow. Yeah, Jello Biafra, who is the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys. Yeah, got a lot of time for him. But he's become quite political. I mean, their music was always a bit political. But yeah, and there's some of their songs are always raising, get sort of my wife saying, "What the hell are you listening to that for?" Because there's songs like, well, let's not go into it. But yeah, there's some very interesting names of songs there, definitely. But yeah, interesting to hear. But did that shape you as a person, that just, like you say, that curiosity about music? And because, again, political music and politics were quite intertwined in various times.
Yeah, maybe I'm not that political, but kind of, like I said, that had been the eras. Then I have found out kind of later on also this car, the Sublime from US, it doesn't exist anymore, and things like that. Well, then I found out Daft Punk as well, so kind of like, you know, from that perspective. So there are different shapes of me in music that you wouldn't imagine. Yes.
Yeah, but I think it does definitely shape you, because I do like sort of those highways and the byways of music. I'm not much mainstream. I don't know about you, Paul. You sort of seek out the sort of the other stuff, or is it just that you're curious about other things you don't know?
So, you know, again, not promoting a particular music app because others are available, but I do quite like sometimes you'll be listening to something that's kind of established, you know it, and then there's a button you can press that lets you pivot and says, show me more in this genre, or show me more by this artist, or, you know, throw me a wild card. And that's how you discover more music. And then you find that and you like that, and you build a bit of a picture up behind you as to, you know, what your tastes are. And that's how I discover, you know, new music, really. It's... you know, I do miss, you know, standing in HMV on a Saturday afternoon on Oxford Street, you know, pouring through the records and, you know, that product that you have in your hand, you know, the sleeve and the artistry and all of that wonderful stuff. But there's certainly something to be said about embracing the digital age and just being able to use that to broaden your creative boundaries, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, there was good things about the old days, but there were bad things too. It was hard to discover new stuff. Now there's, you know, it's very easy to find pretty much any amount of music. But I wonder if sort of around those sort of musical, when you were starting to get into music, when did you become aware of security as a career possibility, as information security? Not wanting to call you old, but was it a job way back when?
Well, kind of, I think it started while I was in my Nokia era, but kind of I have been into computers since I was, I don't even remember how old. I don't know if you remember this Commodore VIC-20.
Yeah.
VIC-20, I had that. I might still have it in my
no
parents'
way.
Closet somewhere. so then of course the 64 version. I think I kind of missed the Amiga times, but then I can get back, you know, into the scene with the first, you know, a bit powerful 120 megahertz PCs.
Whoa.
And those were bloody expensive back then.
Yeah,
so, but then I realized that when I moved into my, you know, own first flat, so I was wondering that what kind of a socket there is in the wall, and it was a network socket. So I think I have been using first of these LA LAN, 10 megabit LAN versions, you know, with my PCs. And of course that started on the computer era, something, you know, maybe, I don't know if I should say it here, but something illegal and legal things as well. And let's say that back then, when you have been, you know, done the file sharing, etc. So of course you need to think about the security aspects, not as a job back then, but kind of, but when I moved on to the Nokia parts, and then I was a service manager for Nokia Developer, which was a huge service back then when the Nokia was the king of the mobile phones. So there was a breach in one of the services and kind of we lost user information. Well, of course, it wasn't that serious. There was only, you know, email, name, and etc. But it was still quite big during that time. And kind of that raised up kind of the awareness on the cyber side that something needs to be done. And we were doing lots of things in Nokia because it was ahead of a curve as well on that time. But then as it was my service, so I kind of started interested when we fixed the incident that should I, that could be a, you know, really interesting career move as well. So I was asking first kind of do a bit more on different services, what we then did on the Nokia developer, and then it eventually graduated, and now here I am as a CISO of Outokumpu. So it has been a journey. So
yeah. How about you, Paul? I don't know, was, because I know you have quite a technical background, but was security part of that curriculum way back then?
In the early days of my career, I was a data nerd, actually, and then moved into e-commerce and web design and project management. In fact, I've got very fond memories of my time at Nokia, where I lived in downtown Helsinki at the turn of the millennium, and worked in Espoo working on a project for NMP, Nokia Mobile Phones, as it was at the time, which was great fun. But security, was it really a consideration? I mean, it was there, but it wasn't first and foremost in people's minds. You know, I'm one of these CISOs that accidentally stumbled into this. I started doing some work in business continuity and disaster recovery, and the role pivoted, and I picked security up on a never look back. And, you know, as I say, I've been doing security leadership now for 20 years. Seems like a long time. But, you know, you're talking about the music topic, you know, music, innovation, security. Going back to Petri's anecdote, you know, I remember the days of Napster when we were starting to get very, very curious about, you know, music in a digital form and how we could access that and how we could consume that content. And, you know, it took the industry a long time to recognize that they had to embrace technical change. And then we started thinking about the security around that. How do you protect intellectual property, digital rights management, and all these wonderful things? So, you know, as society has innovated, technology and ultimately security generally runs behind it, trying to catch up. Certainly security is always running behind everything, trying to catch up. But I think if you fast forward to now, I think we're a little bit more astute thinking about risks, and security is a little bit higher up the agenda. I'm sure, Petri, you'd agree with me. It's not as high as it needs to be, but we're having the conversations a little bit earlier now, which is nice.
It is, and I think kind of raising the cyber culture as well, kind of what we are doing now in the company. So it's not only awareness anymore. So it's how the community would be, you know, enforced, kind of embrace the cyber in all the aspects. And if when we get there, then I think we are one step closer to the better world again. But of course, it takes a lot of time. It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah. No, we've chatted to Jamina from Outokumpu, who's, I think, working on that culture side of it. And yeah, really great conversation, because it was all about language and just the different meanings that people give to particular words and particular actions. And that was just sort of revelatory in sort of how you go about tackling these kind of things. But I wonder, has that getting people to respect and live up to that culture got easier? Because I guess people of our generation, and yet I just called us old, have kind of seen this stuff happen to us rather than our children have grown up with it. I don't know, has that changed anything? I don't know, Paul, if you see that with your kids. I don't know, Petri, I don't know if you have kids or if they worry about these things. Mine certainly don't. They're pretty brazen about these things.
I think there is a challenge there. The younger generation's perception and tolerances of data privacy and digital persona are probably not where they need to be. Yeah. But what's interesting with them is, you know, they live in a society where they own two personas, digital and analog. If you look at the comparison, certainly in the UK education, I'm not sure what it's like in Finland, Petri, I'd love to know, actually. We're still very, very good at institutionalizing safe and secure behaviors, situational and awareness in an analog world. You know, don't talk to strangers, look both ways before you cross the road, and so on and so forth. But digitally, I still don't think we're doing what we need to do. Similarly, you know, if I talk to my child, my eldest has rediscovered Pokemon Go. And I think if you got offered a Pikachu or something like that, and he had to give up his national insurance number, his date of birth, and his inside trouser leg measurement, he's already given you that data. They just don't place the same onus on privacy. So we're going to have to think about that in terms of legal, regulatory, education, awareness, and culture. You know, how we balance what generations want from data privacy versus what they want in terms of innovation and creativity and so on and so forth. There's a lot that's going to change, I think, in a very short space of time. And AI, again, will throw a curveball as well. What's it like in Finland, Petri?
Yeah, I have two girls, kind of 11 and 9 at the moment. So I think it's kind of less the same. So we are teaching that you need to look both ways before you cross the road and kind of be safe on that. But then also it needs lots of education to the girls and also to other kids as well, that you cannot just post something or send something kind of to your friends without thinking, because it will come back to you. And we did with Jemina as well, kind of on my daughter's school as a tryout, this awareness session for how and you should behave in the digital world, as we'd say, from first to sixth graders. So I think it was an eye-opening moment for them as well, when they're realizing. And of course, there were some kids were really aware, kind of been discussing with their parents, but then some of course were a bit less, but there is a lot to do on that
front. We're starting to see the early negative ramifications of oversharing on social media now. So you've kind of got a generation entering into the workforce that maybe have a few sins of the past just sat back in their social media past that are coming back to haunt them. There's been, you know, a few high profile instances of that where somebody's been propelled into the spotlight and the tabloids in the UK have just got after them and mined their social media history and said, oh, they said this and this. And yeah, you know, I was a child of the 80s, and I take some comfort in knowing that, you know, what I got up to is either confined to the memories of people who are probably losing their memories because apparently we're getting old. Thanks, Mark. or they're on 35 millimeter negatives of people who I know, and I have just as much material on them. So there's a very, you know, fractious detente there, which protects us. But as we know, when you share something in the digital cyberspace, social media is there forever. And, you know, that's probably one of the biggest areas where we need to start to think about how we manage that persona. So that conversation needs to start very, very early and needs to kind of propagate all the way through. Otherwise, you could find yourself not getting that job in 10 years' time because of, you know, the way you behaved on X or Facebook or whatever they're using.
Yeah, but I wonder which way it's going to go, whether people are going to get less or more forgiving, just that sort of, and acknowledge that everyone has faults. I mean, admittedly, there are some faults that are unforgivable, but I just wonder if... Yeah, that tolerance will be more widespread. I don't know, Petra, if you see that sort of with newer people joining Outer Kumpu, whether they're easier to persuade or easier to, yeah, they know more about this, so it is an easier job to do.
Well, I think it's a lot to do with the kind of profession you're applying. But if you talk about cybers, then I think people are really aware and cautious when they are entering the scene. That is something kind of I need to say again, the work what Jemina is doing. So we are educating our workforce, so people, to teach their families to what to do, you know, in this digital world. So it's going to be part of the culture journey as well. So like you said, that if there is something you post in the internet and you have a kind of this really important position, you're inside the company, and then you will be blackmailed kind of through your families, you know, these misbehaviors, and saying that give this info or we will, you know, publicly push all of this info out. So that's something what we try to educate to our workforce and families as well, that you need to be really careful what you share.
It's been really challenging though. So I, you know, I remember going back a few years when I was on active duty, should we call it, you know, trying to write social media policies and then market testing them with the workforce, industrial relations, some of the organizations I work for were unionized as well. And we got into lots of sticky conversations about, you know, civil liberties. You can't tell me how I conduct my digital persona. You have no right. And I said, well, yeah, but I do have a right to protect the brand. And you would then start to look at how those analog policies played out in terms of how can you bring an organization into disrepute by the way that you conduct yourself. And then trying to map that to this brave new digital world. And actually, just something you say completely indirectly, not necessarily associated to your work in a particular tenure in a particular organization, but because it's so easy to bring all these digital things together, you're guilty by association. So something you say in the personal capacity could find its way back to you and damage your reputation or your organization's reputation. So the blast radius of something that you say is completely different. But we also have to be respectful of those boundaries, you know, how you behave online. You know, there's only a limited amount of reach. And, you know, as Petra, you've said it a couple of times now, a lot of it just comes down to education, awareness, and just kind of understanding the ramifications of how you do and don't behave. And to your earlier question, Mark, you know, I think will people become more tolerant over time? I think whilst we have the challenges we have with cancel culture and so on and so forth, I don't know, really.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I think you're allowed to not know. We'd be richer, different people if we did know.
Very true. Good point.
But I don't know, Patrick, I feel like we should do a bit more delving into your career. So after Nokia, sort of that breach that got you, I suppose, interested in security, and then information security, was you decided just to go for that from then on? Or was it sort of, I wasn't sure where you jumped to after Nokia, because you were there for a while.
Yeah, so Paul mentioned the Nokia mobile phone, so that was my last kind of employer in the Nokia era before Microsoft bought them, then ended the whole mobile phone business as well. It was kind of all, I would say, InfoSec after that. So I moved to Tietoevry, which is a service provider here in Finland, and kind of course the GDPR helped me a lot when it came in to push out lots of these security privacy controls in. Of course, I thought that when you are moving to a service provider who is offering, selling things, that your security privacy, so you know, is a top-notch thing. Oh boy, I was wrong. And then, of course, I helped them to initiate that to a different level. Then I moved to Wärtsilä, which is this marine provider kind of here in Finland, and kind of responsible for the internal cybersecurity as such. So the Wärtsilä was my customer, kind of creating those kind of things. Then I moved into the operational technology board, to the production sites as well. I knew nothing about OT, but I'm a fast learner and, like I said, curious. So I said that if someone asked me to take care of it, so I will take care of it. And then we build, you know, the new factory to Vaasa, also the Wärtsilä factory Vaasa, based on the designs which my team created. So that was a real big achievement. That's not on my LinkedIn. People have said that I should put it there. Maybe I put it after this. And then, after the period in Wärtsilä, so then Outokumpu came knocking and asking that, do you want to be the CISO of the company? And I said yes. And it was, again, a different industry. Now we are producing stainless steel. So this is a journey again, and we are ramping up lots of things on the company.
Are you the first CISO at Outokumpu?
No. There has been a couple of CISOs before me. And in fact, we did, because we are doing this visual cyber. So we are doing, you know, this podcast and webcast with Yemina as well. So we created a tribute to the former CISO, so they got to share their story as well, that what they did before me and kind of where I'm carrying on the torch onwards, because there are lots of new employees in Outokumpu as well who don't know, you know, the history. So it was really interesting, and it got really good feedback as well, that I'm brave enough to bring, you know, others to the front as well to talk about the history of cyber in Outokumpu.
But I guess, I mean, does that define your approach, that openness, that visibility, I suppose? Because I don't know, Paul, I know you've said in the past that often security are the people in the basement, and they get overlooked and they get trampled on and criticized. But I don't know, it sounds like you're upfront with a lot of these things, Petri, and tell people, show people what good things security can do with them and for them.
Yes, so we are doing this visible cyber. So we try to be visible and not, you know, write just text somewhere. So we create videos, push pictures, so organizing exercises, different events, lots of things. So we try to be everywhere. But of course, we are kind of a Finnish Helsinki-based, so we need to do more work to be global presence on cyber as well. But I'm thinking we are getting the first steps in on that journey to be really successful in this front.
I don't know, Paul, is that sort of something you've seen as well, just the security emerge from those darker corners and start to become more upfront, more visible, more, I mean, like, as you said earlier, it should be taken more seriously, but is it starting to happen?
I think some members of the security industry have taken a little bit of persuading to recognize that they are servant to the organizations that they serve, and that they need to emerge from the shadows and demonstrate how they add value. But, you know, to Petri's point, I think one of the qualities that I learned quite early on in my career was to show an interest in the organization that I served, be curious, ask lots of questions, put myself in their shoes, and then demonstrate through a lens of customer success how I can help them balance risk with reward. The prerequisite of that, I think, is ensuring that the organization recognizes that they are part of the problem and part of the solution, you know, that security is a collective responsibility. You know, a thing I say, you know, to people who are starting in cybersecurity is what they don't teach you in CISO school, one of our more popular podcasts, look it up if you haven't, is one of the important qualities of cybersecurity leadership and management now, but it ripples down to everybody who does it, is your ability to sell and to market what it is that we do. How do we contribute? So rather than being the friction or being the autocrat or the police person, how are we adding value? You have to sell yourself sometimes, you know, and you can't do that if you are locked in a basement behind, you know, three lines of security, physical security, and nobody can access you. So to Petri's point, you've got to get out there and shake hands and make friends, 100%.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. I think it's certainly a change I've seen that is that a reason I took up security, started writing about it, is because nobody else did. They didn't see it as interesting. And then sort of, and I would like to say I was smart enough to spot that it was going to become a big thing, but I wasn't. It was just lucky. And it, you know, it went from that teenagers messing about with stuff, some of that to do with music, but also just starting to, you know, see on the DDoS attacks on early web companies and those kinds of things. And then it just got more and more serious because the extortion started, and then just the organized crime got involved, and went on from there. And you know, that early contacts experience and I built up sort of made me interested in it, definitely. But it has, and it is becoming much more serious and important. But Petri, I don't know if it's that, I guess your organization takes it pretty seriously anyway, but could they go further? Are there more things that you would like them to do?
Yeah, I think we are in a lucky position that we are at kind of a cyber one material risk in Outokumpu. So it's in the annual report, and it has the, you know, the board of directors support, and they are really interested on the topic, how we are moving forward and asking, you know, the updates. Of course, you could always have interest on that area, but there is so much things what we need to do as well in the manufacturing industry. And we are kind of creating as well this sharing, you know, information with different, you know, Finnish companies at the moment, or kind of how, you know, the OT is secured. So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. So we are sharing information on that part as well. I hope to get that, you know, on global, some global or local level, maybe in Sweden, Germany, US as well, that there would be, you know, kind of a companies willing to share these things, that how we can protect the nation, for example, as a community.
Picking up on that, that's something that I have started to notice across a number of different vertical markets, whereas, you know, if I go back to 2010, 2011, there was still this issue that sharing information on cyber threat and cyber threat mitigation could be considered competitive advantage. So there was a real lack of interest on the part of leadership teams and organizations to share with, you know, what are essentially competitors in other, you know, similar vertical markets. But I think what we've now started to realize and reflect on a little bit more is actually there is some strength in trying to protect the sector as well. And, you know, rather than those conversations happening between CISOs on, you know, shady, unprotected back channels of communication that shouldn't really be happening, that information sharing is now being encouraged, be that through the state, through information sharing. So in the UK, we've got the Cyber Information Sharing Partnership. But in the financial services, you've got FSISAC, you know, and in the ISF, we have communities that share special interest and they exchange these things. And there's a real power and a real value in that. And I'm so pleased that we've got past that. Oh, no, we can't share. We're going to keep this to ourselves. It just doesn't make sense in the broader term and in the bigger picture that we keep that sort of thing to ourselves. And there's just so much going on now that it's just detrimental to everybody if we hold on to this information. So that I'm really pleased has changed.
Yeah, I think so. I think as you've demonstrated, Petri, and are working on, yeah, security permeates every part of life these days. You know, so much of what we do depends on technology and keeping some of those things secure and understanding the risks involved with it, that, yeah, I'd be amazed if it couldn't be made better by sharing information about it. Yeah, that information, that security through obscurity, yeah, it does not work so well. Absolutely not. But yeah, I just want to thank Petri for his time, for being so candid about his career. Paul as well, always a pleasure. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Just search for Dear InfoSec where you get your podcasts, or look for our page on Audioboom where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.